ready to blast off in the exploration rocket for Module 6, Part 2. Well, I mean, I'm sick of hearing welcome to. So I figured we'd change the greeting. Now, does anybody have any outstanding questions so far on Chapter 6? Anybody having trouble with concepts? Any questions they'd like to pose about subnetting and stuff? I'm writing up some exercises later on today, which will go out and go up on the server that will hopefully continue to work. I'm pulling out these big long ones, Grace, because we can't get at the pegs. What? I'm pulling out the big long ones because we can't get at the pegs. There we go. Now we can. Up behind your computer. Anybody got any questions? I'll stop talking now. All right, snap question. No, how many hosts how many hosts can you have on a subnet with a subnet mask of .192?
62.
That is correct. Anybody know how we did that?
Correct.
How many did you say? 62?
62, yep.
Didn't you take all the bits to the far right? Didn't you have the two far left bits set to 0 and all the bits from 1 through 6 position set to 1 and add up the difference?
If it was me, I would have said .192, 256 minus 192 is 64, and because it's 2 to the power of 6 minus 2 is how you get the number of hosts, because 2 to the power of 6 is 64, we can assume that we can have 62 hosts on that subnet. I'm not sure the reasoning procedure that Robert went through. You can perhaps enlighten us, but it may have been something along those lines.
I did the same thing, and probably after you do a number of subnets, you'll just remember that a subnet of 25 is 126 hosts, and a subnet with 26 has 62, and a subnet of 27 has 30, and so on.
But to answer your question, Josh, you are correct. If you have a subnet mask of 255.255.255.192, the two most significant bits are set to 1, and the right-hand 6 bits are set to 0, which means that if you see that there are 6 host bits, you can say 2 to the power of H minus 2, is 2 to the power of the number of host bits subtract 2 will give you the number of usable IP addresses on the subnet. Alrighty, so if that's the case, how many hosts could we have on a subnet that was 255.255.254.0?
510.
Anybody else agree with Robert? Who are you talking to? Who are you talking to, Grace? I don't know. Is Ruchi here, guys? Yeah, you're going to have to walk over and talk to her, Grace. Don't just yell from there. Does anybody else want to know how we work through that one? 255.255.254.0? Shall we work through that one? Alrighty. Because I've thrown a curveball at you guys, haven't I? 255.255.254.0. Now, 254 in binary is 1111 1110. Okay, so what we have is we have 23 ones and 9 zeros in our subnet mask. Hang on. Yeah, that's right. Anybody see that? So we've got 255, that's 16 ones, 254, which is another 7 ones, and then we have 9 lots of 0. The key of a subnet mask is knowing how many bits are in the network portion, and how many bits are in the host portion. So for our subnet mask, if we have 255.255.254, we actually say 255, that's 8 bits, 255, that's another 8, so we've got 16. We then convert 254 into binary, which I can do, so 254. The largest power of 2 for 254 is 128, so I put a 1. And I have 254 minus 128 is 126, so I can take 64 off that. So I get 62, so I put another 1, and then I minus 32, and I get 30, so I put another 1, and then I minus 16, then I minus 16, and I get 14, so I put a 1, and then I subtract 8, and I put a 1, I get a 6, I subtract 4, and I get 2, so I put a 1, and then I subtract 2, and something went wrong there. But essentially, I get 1111110, and that is 254 in binary. Any questions about that conversion? Yes, Joshua, you said hello into chat. So basically what we do with the subnet masks is for any quantity that we have 255 for, we know that we've got 8 ones. And then for the other quantity, we then convert that into binary and we count how many ones are in that number that we've converted. And because it's a subnet mask, all of the ones have to be on the left-hand side. And we count the number of ones that we have for our network portion, which in this particular example is 23 ones. And we count the number of zeros that we have. Well, obviously 23 plus a certain number has got to equal 32 because the addresses are 32 bits long. And we have 9 zeros, so we know we have 9 host bits and 23 network bits. We then say 2 to the power of 9, which is 512, minus 2 gives us 510 usable hosts. Questions, queries, clarification, confusion. Okie dokie. Later there are going to be some typed up exercises that I'm going to type up for you guys. Has anybody tried doing the exercises that are embedded in the chapter?
I looked at them. I think I worked a few of them.
Yeah, you're not my primary concern, Robert. You're doing pretty well at subnetting at this stage. You will probably have to whiz through the exercises I post up, but I don't think they'll cause you too much grief. Okie dokie. Now, the whole point of subnetting is that we are running out of...
I did good on the binary to decimal and decimal to binary.
Yeah. Go ahead, Josh. You good on the decimal to binary and the binary to decimal. Is there a but there?
Yeah, but when I got to the exercises about taking the... 192.168.1-24 and actually figuring out, you know, how many subnets there were, I kind of didn't do so well on those.
Okie dokie, we will be covering those later in the lecture. Is anybody downloading? No? Okay, just checking, we're seeing a ping of 269 here. It's not too bad, but... it's all right. Can't be. Can't. Oh, I mean, you can pull it down. It's... Yeah, fair enough. Okay. No worries. Thank you, Kieran. Xcode decided it wanted documentation, so we'll do that a little bit later. Now, one of the things they want us to cover in the course for Chapter 6 is the address ranges that have been reserved for various things. Now, has everybody seen the reserved addresses listed in the chapter for the privately non-routable IP addresses?
I don't think I remember all of them, but I believe I've seen.
In theory, you should actually... They are actually in there, and they're all listed in there. Basically, we have Class A network that is 10 dot. We have 16 Class Bs from 172.16 to 172.31, and we have a Class C. We have 254 Class Cs from 192.168.0 to 192.168.254. That ringing any bells for anyone?
There's the 169 address.
Yes, there is. That is the APIPA, or Automatic Private IP Address Allocation Range, that is used by machines who wish to obtain an IP address in the absence of DHCP and static configuration. So, has anybody ever had a Windows machines connected to the network, and when they've done an IP config, they've had a 169.254 address?
Is that only a Windows phenomenon? Because I think I've only ever seen that happen on Windows.
Actually, Brian, there is a daemon under Linux that will actually do the APIPA configuration and will give your network interface is 169.254 in the absence of a DHCP server with static configuration, but it isn't something that's installed on most Linux boxes by default. One of the things we did, Gemma and I, that is, a few years ago, because we were bored geeks on a Thursday night, was we hooked two laptops together with a crossover cable, and we actually used the APIPA addresses to share out network resources, and we wanted to test whether the APIPA would actually function and give us network connectivity without us having to configure anything, and it did. Okie dokie. Now, one of the things they tell us is that the 10 dot addresses, the 172.16 to 172.31 and the 192.168.x dot, and in fact the 169.254 addresses, are not to be routed on the internet by internet routers. Which is interesting, because if you actually do a trace route with a 192.168 address through my ISP, it actually goes four hops before it actually gets blocked. So I'm glad to see we're all following the RFCs. Okie dokies. Now,
that's really cool.
Well, not really. It's not very useful because it's being handed out to the default gateways. There's no way to actually make use of that unless you actually poison the routing tables of the upstream routers, which I really can't see your ISP being too happy about.
Does it have any practical effect on anything? Does it slow things down?
Well, you could say that if you were sending out packets with private IP addresses onto the ISP's network and it was routing through four of the upstream routers, it could be argued that if you sent enough of those packets, you could cause somewhat of a denial of service. And it could be argued from a security standpoint that perhaps those packets should be dropped at the first, if not all of the border routers.
You'd also create a bit of a mess with routing tables, because you'd have, in theory, on the same ISP, all kinds of duplicates. Everybody that had a Linksys router would have a 192.168.1.x and duplicates all over the place.
One of the interesting things to keep in mind, though, however, is that there are ISPs that do use the non-routable addresses inside their networks to route between their own machines, so that they don't actually require publicly routable IP addresses. So if you're actually accessing stuff on the ISP's network, there are actually times when if you are connected to them and working through their DNS servers, they will actually use internally routable IP addresses to conserve IP allocation space, because there is actually a shortage of IPv4 addresses, and you have to rent those addresses, and they can be quite expensive to route to clients.
It just seems kind of lazy to me. I mean, I think if they're not going to change those default gateways, it makes me wonder what else they have just thrown up there without, you know, maybe configuring it as well as it should be.
Well, a number of years ago, we had a significant problem with a lot of mail servers being configured as open relays. So a mail server that would accept mail from anywhere and attempt to deliver it to anywhere. And as we know, the spammers took advantage of all the open relays, and as a result, many IT managers and consultants and stuff had to configure mail servers not to be as open as previously. Okie dokie. Any questions on the reserved IP addresses so far? Any of that sort of stuff? Alrighty, I will take that as a no. Now they're saying that when you are actually designing
the 172 address. I'm sorry, I've been late.
What
there.
About it? It's
is
right.
It the same as like the 192 in that it's for private routers and stuff, or does it have some other special purpose?
Yeah, it's the same. It's for private routers and stuff. 172.16 to 172.31 are the class B addresses that you can allocate.
I've seen 10.1 and 192.168 all over the place.
There are some examples in the chapter text with 172.16 and stuff, so they have put it in there. Now, the other thing that we have is when you're actually building networks, it's important to document the IP addresses. I had an IT manager friend of mine, that had the networking policy of if you pinged a random IP address and it didn't respond, big fella, you can put your server on that IP address. No. No, because if a workstation or another device had been using that address and it was powered down, it would not respond to the ping, and then when you powered up the previous device, you would end up with an address conflict, which was always fun to sort out. So I pushed very strongly for the documentation of the allocation of IP addresses so that we didn't have to just ping stuff and see if it responded to see if something had already been allocated there.
Wouldn't DHCP fix it?
Well, if you're allocating things like servers and stuff, DHCP shouldn't be used to allocate addresses to machines right. That need to be statically allocated. I remember somebody was talking last week, I can't remember who it was, that you can go into your router and you can put in MAC address to IP reservations so that the same addresses are always allocated to... Hello, mobile phone. Are always allocated to that particular machine. Can anybody think of a problem with this?
Well, if you change network card.
Yeah, that's one problem. What about another problem?
If you're connecting to with the computer that's got two cards, like an Ethernet card or a wireless card.
Well, you can assign an address to each of them. But what if your significant other goes and spills coffee on the router that you've put all the configuration into? And it goes sizzle bang, and that's the end of it. And because
then
you haven't
reload
done...
reload the backup, I'm sure you may.
How many people have backed up the configuration of their routers? Quick poll.
I used to do it.
I haven't, but I haven't made a Mac to static IP table. I've changed the password, added a WPA code that I have printed out somewhere else, and that's about all I've done to my router.
Fair enough. You're a bit loud, by the way. I don't know whether that's just you or just you're particularly loud today. There we go. or maybe I'm just oversensitive. Yeah, okay, so very important. I know. Okay, so people, I would strongly recommend that if you have spent any amount of time putting in web keys, WPA passphrases, changing the default password. Who hasn't changed the default password on their router? You don't have to own up to it, but you know, that's a bad idea, don't you, to not change from the default password, because you go on Google and you look up router default password D-Link, and then up comes a little page with every default password for every default router that's out there, okay? So if you haven't changed the default password on your router, you obviously trust everybody on your internal network. And if you can do that, that's cool. Sadly, if your friends come over, that might not be so cool.
Well, by the way, if you're not sure, if you're thinking people just won't know what router you're connecting to, there's only about half a dozen username/password combinations and the default ones in the entire world, even though there are about 69,105 different router configurations.
Yep, that's right.
They all use admin and password.
I actually had one that used root and 0p3n for the open networks routers, which was different.
Ooh. Nice.
Because the open network routers were actually a little router running BusyBox. And that was kind of cool. It ran a little copy of Linux. And you could SSH into it, which was very funky. If I remember correctly, you're running a Linksys, aren't you, Brian, I think, with funky firmware?
I have one of those, and I also have a weird one because I have a whack of 4 or 5 IPsec tunnels, and that's the stuff I want to back up because they took me forever to create and get working.
Yeah, IPsec is not an easy protocol to configure, and once you've messed around with AH and ESP, encapsulated security payload, and all that sort of stuff, you want to back that up.
I just like to get the IP address of every person that says that they're running router without having changed their passwords. I appreciate it.
Look, unfortunately, we won't be having that on lecture today, sadly, Drew. You'll have to save that for another day.
Okay.
But obviously, okay. And I'm sure they'll give it to you, Drew. I'm sure they will.
If they haven't changed their passwords, then, you know, they're open and trusting people.
That's right. I know a whole stack of people, for example, who do not have a secure wireless network. Does anybody here still have an open wireless network? And we'll try not to laugh too hard.
I don't even have an open wireless network on my mobile phone.
I don't, but I plan on, if necessary, using it as defense.
Okay. Well, anyway, so if you have an open network that doesn't have any security codes on it because they really were too difficult to key into your iPhone, I would strongly recommend that you actually go and set a password on your wireless network and make sure that you have one on there so that you don't have people literally driving past your house and using your wireless network for things that they possibly shouldn't. When I first moved into our block of units in 2006, we were the only wireless network in the area. Encrypted with WEP, of course, I might add. Now, there are 7. Admittedly, 4 of them are mine, but there are 7.
Yeah, I don't know what it's like in the new place because they don't have a Wi-Fi card in this, but I remember in my old place there were probably, at any given time, you could get half a dozen different wireless networks, and 4 of them were 2-wire.
We know of a person, I don't know the person personally, but he literally, when he goes on holidays, carries a 2.4 gigahertz Yagi beam in his backpack, so that when he sets up in the motel, he can figure out which direction to point it and steal free internet. And he has never had a problem getting free internet when he's on holidays with his Yagi.
I think I know who that is.
No, you don't. It's not someone you know.
Fair.
What's a Yagi?
It's a type of directional antenna. I believe it's the name of a subclass of directional beam antenna. If you can figure out how to spell it, I'm sure Wikipedia will enlighten you on exactly what a Yagi is. Ah, Y-A-G-I. There you go. So you can look it up on Wikipedia and it'll give you all the gruesome details of how they're built.
Speaking of which, if you want to have fun, you can use... I can't remember exactly what the technology is, but some sort of...
Hang on a second.
Well, not really technology, just cans of stuff.
Yep. Apparently you can build one with a ferrite rod, a threaded bolt, and a Pringles tin. A threaded rod. Yep. And you put the discs on the threaded roll, on the threaded bolt, and you stick that in the Pringles tin, and you then have your little Yagi that you point in the direction that you would like the signal to go. And if you do some pretty souped-up Googling, you can actually find all sorts of designs that use Pringles tins, coffee tins, all sorts of other household items to build wireless networks. One of my friends actually made a 2.4 gigahertz reflector with some cardboard, some aluminium foil, and some careful cutting, and he made himself a little parabolic dish that he could amplify his wireless signal with. Not for the faint of heart. Okay, back to the boring stuff. Okay, any questions so far? Alrighty. Now, when you are assigning the addresses to your networks, you should possibly look at which devices should have publicly routable IP addresses. Believe it or not, they would be the machines that you would like to access from the internet if you have more than one publicly routable IP address. Otherwise, you may have to use port forwarding and all sorts of things like that. If you... have machines that do have publicly routable IP addresses, it's very important that you protect them behind firewalls and things so that they don't get attacked. Does anybody remember the blaster worm?
How can we forget?
I got hit with that.
It changed the world, man.
Yeah, a bit like the ping of death and nuke and smurf and all those sorts of things. But yes, all these security exploits over the years have changed the world. But yes, the blaster worm was a particularly bad one. And at the time the blaster worm came out, I had 64 routable IP addresses from my ISP. And, well, let's just say I got a few machines that were telling me that the RPC service was shutting down. And I had to go and tidy them all up.
I think there are a few betas of Vista that are vulnerable to the ping of death.
Wow.
Well, that's why they're beta. Okay.
Yeah, because they rebuilt the network stack, so it's kind of proof that they stole it from Unix in 2000.
They did. Well, it's modeled very closely on the Unix network stack, which is kind of handy if you're a program developer. Okay, should hosts be statically or dynamically allocated? Okay, you've got to ask yourself the question, which I just did. And the answer is machines that have things such as file servers and printers and things that you need to be able to access reliably should probably be statically assigned, because you don't want the file server floating around the network. You have your workstations dynamically assigned. And there are a number of utilities you can use to do that. You can use RAP, which is really deprecated and stuff, but you can. You can use BootP, which most people don't use either, but you can set that up. And DHCP, Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol. Has anyone, I'm not even going to ask, has anyone not seen DHCP? I'm sure you've all come across it. It's the technology that when you plug all the cables in or set up the right SSIDs and key in the right keys, that allows your workstations to obtain addresses automatically from your router.
It's the magic thing that makes stuff work.
Well, it attempts to assist in making stuff work. But yes, DHCP will hand out various configuration information to workstations. Some of the bits of information that are handed out are IP address, subnet mask, optionally the default gateway, the DNS servers that the machine should use, time servers, all sorts of other things can be handed out via DHCP. Generally speaking, it's usually only IP address, subnet mask, default gateway, and DNS servers. But if you are running Linux or another more capable router brand, you can actually send out other pieces of information. So, one of the problems with entering the IP address subnet mask and stuff into every workstation if they're static is that when things change, you've got to go and reconfigure all the workstations by hand, and it's very easy for somebody to mistype an IP address and cause the workstation to be unable to reach the rest of the network, which is why if you configure your dynamic pool correctly and you need to allocate addresses from an address pool, it can greatly reduce typing errors provided you manage to type it correctly on the DHCP server. Okay. The other reason you need to assign servers static IP addresses, and these static IP addresses should be assigned outside the DHCP range. Okay? Unless you've got a MAC reservation for them and it's still a risky thing to do. You should assign your static addresses outside the DHCP range, and you would want to assign PCs static addresses if you were looking at doing port forwards to the PC, such as if you wanted to run a web server, an FTP server, or something else. Because if you have a router that does not save persistent state for DHCP, and your lease times out and stuff and significant time passes, it's possible for your workstation to be handed out a different IP address and all port forwards will then no longer function. Unless the technology in question uses universal plug and play. Any questions? Any comments? Anything anybody would like to talk about?
So if you've got a router that, you know, like a 192.168 router, you can have the DHCP pool go from 192.168.0.0 to 192.168.0.255. Can you then assign your static pool from 192.168.1.0, say? Or are you limited to just the last digit?
No.
You're messing with stuff.
No, remember the subnet mask stuff? 192.168.0. dot with a subnet mask of 255.255.255.0 says that the first three bytes relate to the network address. So, for example, and don't forget we cannot assign a host to the .0 address, which is the network address, and we cannot assign one to the broadcast address, which is .255. So what, for example, you might do is you might have your DHCP pool running from 100 to 200, just as an example, 192.168.1.0.100 to 192.168.0.200, and then you might have all of your servers allocated from, say, 2 through to 20, which would keep the servers outside the DHCP pool, but allow the workstations that come temporarily onto your network to be allocated IP addresses from the dynamic range. Okie dokie. Has anybody been into their router, assuming that you can get into your router, and investigated the DHCP configuration and stuff inside your router? And I would recommend that if you are going to go and try this after lecture, one of these don't try this at home kiddies disclaimer applies. Don't change anything unless you understand what you're doing. Unless, of course, you have that backup of your router's configuration that I told you about earlier that you can restore in case something goes terribly wrong.
And if you don't, you can make
VLAN and it broke.
Brian, I missed that. Drew talked over the top of you. He's significantly louder than you are, sadly.
I was good until mine, one of these alternate firmware said it could support VLANs, and it started saying it could hand out multiple ranges of DHCP, and then it got all broke and funny.
Ah, yes. Now, a VLAN, which we don't talk about yet, is the way to run more than one network on the same wiring, and you basically have a VLAN ID that tags the packets so that you can actually run, say, you know, four or five different networks on the same cable infrastructure, and you basically separate the VLANs out based on their VLAN ID, and then you get to deal with whether the packets are tagged and untagged, and whether they're tagged on this interface and untagged on that one, and it all gets a bit nasty, but it is kind of a cool technology, and if you have, say, for example, a building that contains infrastructure wiring, and you have, say, three or four 4 different companies and stuff, or 3 or 4 different sections of the company, it is possible to run all of the traffic on the same wiring, but just vary the VLAN IDs.
Anybody who wants to play with it in these sort of DDWRT or sort of alternate firmwares, be careful, because at least in DDWRT, it's very broken and doesn't work.
Yeah, it also requires a certain chip switch chip. If you don't have the ADM6996, you also need to make sure that your version of the alternate firmware supports the particular Broadcom chip or whatever you happen to have in your router of choice, and that chip can actually support the VLAN stuff, because often there's hardware dependent stuff that needs to operate for it to work. Alrighty, now we get on to some basic subnetting stuff. Okay, some more supposedly basic subnetting stuff. Okay, we're all cool with the fact that we have an IP address which is 32 bits long, and we have a subnet mask that tells us whether how many bits are for the network portion and how many bits are for the host portion. Everybody kind of cool with that? Okie dokie. There will also be some. There will be some swish bang easy exercises. Well, not easy as in easy to do, but easy for you to read exercises that we will come up with later on today and post those up either on the website somewhere or that sort of thing. And there will be exercises where you have to make subnets for various little organisations that I make up. In fact, a couple of classes ago we had Busy Builders, but we'll have some other company names that will be just as tacky, and that you'll be responsible for the subnetting of those particular organisations. Alrighty. Now, one of the things that... Sorry, Drew?
Nothing important. I don't mean to talk over people. When I talk, no one's talking, and then it comes out like 3 seconds.
Oh, it happens to all of us. It's not your fault.
Yeah, it happens due to the delay. You don't necessarily know that somebody has started talking when you key up, and we understand that there is a delay, and this does happen. We're not painting you as a nasty person, at least not today anyway.
Oh, good.
Alrighty. Now, one of the things that you might ask yourself, well, you probably won't ask yourself, but your router will ask itself, is how do I know whether an IP address I have been handed is on the same network as me or not? Okay. Now, does everybody remember what their routing table looks at? It looks like if we open a command prompt and we do route print, does everybody have vague memories of what that looks like from a couple of weeks ago, where you have the IP addresses, the subnet masks, and the destination IP addresses for the routes? Well, if you said vaguely, it's time to open the command prompt and type route space print. Okay, and we will wait for everybody to open their command prompt and type in route/print. So that's Windows R, CMD for your command prompt. That's Charlie Mike Delta. And route space print. Your command prompt will give you your current routing table. And for those of you who feel adventurous as a student challenge exercise, you can redirect that into a text file and have a look at it later. And that might make it easier for you to go through with JAWS, because that is actually a table. It isn't actually a web formatted table, so JAWS isn't going to play well with the columns. It may use tabs, I'd have to have a look. But it might be even possible to pull it into a spreadsheet or whatever and have a really good look at that if you sort of feel that way inclined. Alright, so we have these destination network addresses, we have subnet masks, and we have the gateway. Alright, say for example we have your bog standard ISP configuration. Say for example we have... you have your default network configuration of 192.168.1.0 with a subnet mask of 255.255.255.0, okay? We're not going to sing the whole lecture, though, because that would just be tedious. How does the router know whether an IP address that is handed to it is on its network or not? Okay. What it does is, so the router is handed the IP address of 192.168.1.57. And what it does is it takes that IP address and it performs what we call a logical AND, okay, with the subnet mask. Now, a logical AND is one of the binary operations that is part of Boolean arithmetic. So what you do is you convert the numbers to binary and you perform this operation on them. Now, when you are dealing with logic, you can have two states. You can have on and off, okay? One and zero. Yes or no. Okay, so it's either a true or a false. No, I won't make that joke because I'll get accused of discrimination. It was basically, and that is how your logic operates. Has anybody been to one of those houses where you walk through one side of a room and turn a light switch on, walk through the room without tripping over the dog, the cat, the coffee table, etc., because the light is on, and then at the other end of the room you flick the next light switch down and it turns the light off? Has anybody seen that arrangement?
Yes.
That is called an XOR gate, because basically it's an exclusive OR. In other words, one of the switches can be on and the other switch will be off to have the light switch on, will have the light on, or the other switch will be on and the first switch will be off and the light will be on. If both switches are off or both switches are on, the light will be off. Alrighty, now, and that's an XOR gate, and that's just a practical example of logic. It's a sort of a more complex one. Oh, okay, yeah, well, you can have them wired backwards, and if you would have a light on for a week because of that, that would be unfortunate. May I recommend the Java applet called The Voice, and if you have a camera-enabled phone that is not an iPhone, unfortunately, you can run this Java applet, and it will act as your light sensor. Just for the recording, because I've spoken about The Voice before. www.seeingwithsound.com. Now, if you are doing a logical AND, when you do a logical operation, you work with a bit at a time. Okay? So, you look at one bit, you look at a second bit, and then you get a result. Okay? An AND gate, if you picture a tap, or if you picture a hose with two taps on it, and the two taps are in line on the same hose, the only time the water will come out the sprinkler is if both taps are on. Does everybody understand that? So the water goes from the water supply through the first tap, through the second tap, and out the sprinkler. And if you turn either of the taps off, you'll get no flow of water out of the sprinkler or whatever's on the end of the hose. Everybody cool with that? Okie dokie. That is what we call an AND gate, because for the output of the gate to be a 1, both of the inputs must be a 1. So we end up with the following truth table. If I were you, and you don't know this, I would have a notepad document open to write this down. Or go back over the recording later and pull it out. 0 and 0 is 0 because both inputs are a 0, therefore the output will be a 0. 1 and 0 is 0 because we have a 1 and a 0. Both of the inputs are not 1, therefore the output is a 0. 0 and 1 is 0. Because both of our inputs are not a 1. 1 and 1 is 1, because both of the inputs are a 1, therefore the output is a 1. Note when I say AND, I am not performing addition. No, you're just defining a state. That is correct. I'm doing a logical operation. Now, I will cover the other gates briefly, because for completeness, but this is not covered in the notes, okay? Underline, not covered in the notes. The OR gate will output a 1 if either or both of the inputs is a 1. So 1 or 0 is 1. 0 or 1 is 1. 1 or 1 is 1. 0 or 0 is 0. If either of the outputs, if either of the inputs to the gate is a 1, the result of the OR will be a 1. If you want to picture that in a real-world scenario, you have a water supply with two hoses running to the same sprinkler, and you have a tap on either hose, and if either of those taps is turned on, water will come out of the sprinkler. Now, there are other gates. For example, there is an exclusive gate which I spoke about earlier. An exclusive OR says that if one of the inputs to the gate is a 1, then the output of the gate will be a 1. However, if both of the inputs to a gate are 1, or both of the inputs of a gate are 0, you will get 0. Questions before we go back to Andy. Has anybody seen this? Has anyone not seen this stuff before? There should be a couple of you that haven't seen this stuff before. And there is no shame in not seeing it before, honestly. Yep, fair enough, no problem.
I'm a bit confused about this OR gate, because it said, you know, you said that if either input, how did you say it? But could there not be an OR gate where the output is 0 as well? I'm sort of not phrasing this correctly. Hang on a sec.
That's okay. I'll see if I can correct you while you shake things up in there. An OR gate is a 1 if either or both of the inputs is a 1. So either this one or that one or both of them. Think of it, if you walk up to the cafe and you buy a sandwich or a bread roll, you're going to eat something, okay? So you've eaten something. But if you buy a sandwich and a bread roll, you've still eaten something. But if you don't buy a sandwich or a bread roll, you've eaten nothing. It's a silly example, but do you sort of understand where I'm going with that one?
Silly it may be, but it actually makes it clear.
Okie dokie. And, yes, Alex.
When would we use the OR or the exclusive OR statements for subnetting?
You can use the OR gate to calculate the broadcast address. You can also, you wouldn't necessarily use the exclusive OR in networking, but as I did say, I am covering the three primary gate types for completeness. The primary one that you will deal with in this course is an AND gate. Okie dokie, now if you want Yeah, no worries. If you want more information on Boolean logic, there is an excellent article in Wikipedia on Boolean logic, and there are also all sorts of university lecture material that you can Google up on Boolean logic. Obviously, you can also bring your questions to lecture if you have any on if you have any questions on that. Okay, now, what happens with a router is when it looks at an IP address, getting back to this router, it takes the destination IP address and it ANDs it with the subnet mask. Okay, so it performs a logical AND with the subnet mask. So what happens is the bits that are set to 1 in the subnet mask leave the corresponding bits turned on in the IP address. Ooh, I know, he shouldn't be making those sorts of statements. They're pretty, you know, psycho. But what happens is when you AND the subnet mask with the IP address, any of the bits that are turned on as binary 1 in the IP address are left turned on. Any of the bits that are set to 0 in the subnet mask are turned off in the IP address. Can anybody who might be into lateral thinking tell me if you AND the IP address with the subnet mask of the network, what are you going to end up with? Does anybody know? I'll give you all a clue. All of the host bits will be set to 0.
A broadcast address?
Nope, sorry, the network address.
A subnet mask? No, it'd be a network, I think. A network address, I think.
Yes, you would get the network address. Because all of the host bits are set to 0. As a result of that, you would actually get... So if you have 192.168.1.0... and you AND it with 255.255.255.0, because you're ANDing the first byte with 255, you'll get 192. Because you are ANDing the second byte with 255, you will get 168. If you are ANDing the third byte with 255, you will get 1. And if you AND the last byte with 0, you get 0. Therefore, the result is 192.168.1.0. What I intend to do, if anybody is interested later on today, is write you out some examples to read through. I think that might clarify it a bit for people. So basically, the router grabs the destination IP address, it ANDs it with the subnet mask, and it finds out whether the address is on the same network. If it is on the same network, it sends the packet directly out the interface that is bound to that network. Can anybody tell me what happens if the IP address is not on the same network?
The packet's sent out to the other interface, presumably, which is... the next hop to the outside world.
Well, what actually happens is the router consults its routing table, which it has, and it looks up and sees whether the IP address matches any... I'm answering the question. The router looks up its routing table, and it checks whether any of the routes in its routing table match the destination IP address of the packet. If the IP address matches the destination IP address of the packet in one of its routing tables, it is forwarded to that specific route. If none of those match and a default route is configured or a gateway of last resort, the packet is forwarded to the default gateway. Anybody got any... So, if you have a home router, and it has 192.168.1.0 and 255.255.255.0, and the packet is destined for 192.168.1.something, it will be sent to the machines on the local network. If it then has another route of 0.0.0.0 to your default gateway, any other packets that are not on the 192.168.1.0 network will be sent to the default gateway. Any questions on that? Any queries, comments? Don't get me wrong, guys. I understand that this is conceptually difficult to come to terms with, and I do not expect everybody to understand it on the first run through. And I'm quite happy to answer questions on this in future lectures, or you can call me up on Skype or whatever and talk to me about it. And we can certainly iron out any problems that you may be having with the concepts. Alrighty, now one of the things I want to talk about before we finish up, because I think we've had a pretty heavy lecture today, actually, and whilst I'm not going to finish horrendously early, I'm going to cover a few more things, and then we're going to finish up, and I think that the actual exercises that get set will probably clarify a lot of the confusion, or at least help pinpoint the exact source of the confusion. The other couple of things I want us to cover are ping and traceroute, which I think we've talked about. Ping sends ICMP echo requests. Just move that microphone up a bit so I get a few less P's. That's better. And you send an ICMP echo request to a host, and if the host is responding and there aren't security measures in place, you should receive an ICMP echo reply. Last time I checked, it is possible to open a command prompt and type ping space www.qcat.org and get a meaningful response back from the ping command. Has anybody tried that?
Working at the moment.
Exactly. And it says pinging cavi. Well, internally here it says pinging cavi.qcat.org 192.168.100.6, which is our internal address, and I get 4 packets back. And one of the pieces of information that you get is the time to live field, which I have previously discussed, as I explained, is decremented by 1 each time a packet passes through a router. And it will tell me how many routers, in theory, the packet has been through, provided they follow the standards, by looking at the maximum value of the TTL, and then the TTL value I get back will tell me how many routers it's been through. And it will give me the round trip time, which is the time taken for the packet to reach the destination and the time taken for the packet to reach me. So in a real world example, if I were, which I'm not, going to ask Grace to go and order me a coffee from the cafe, the round trip time would be the time taken for her to walk to the cafe, order the coffee, get the said coffee, and bring the coffee back to me. I actually brought the coffee back this morning, but that is the definition of round trip time. Obviously, as networks get faster, the round trip times decrease. Does anybody remember doing internet over dial-up when we used to deal with round-trip times of, say, 300 milliseconds?
Oh, yes, I remember those days.
If you ever want to see a definition of infuriation, try Facebook on dial-up. Or YouTube, for that matter. Alrighty, so when you look at these round-trip times, they will tell you things of how the network is performing. If you are using traceroute, which uses the time-to-live field of the packets, and it's discussed in the notes, it sends out a packet with the TTL set to 1. The first router in the path will decrement the TTL count, and provided that ICMP, or Internet Message Control Protocol, is not blocked, the machine will return a time exceeded message along with the IP address of the router that time exceeded message came from, and that will show you what the first router is. The second packet for the traceroute is sent out with a TTL of 2, and it will actually return a time exceeded from the next router along the path. Okay, now the ICMP protocol is used for returning certain messages to hosts when things go wrong. Sometimes ICMP is administratively blocked altogether, and in fact one of the things that you will notice, we talked about the problems with MTU discovery, and we talked about the fact that if you didn't reduce your MTU on PPPoE links, SSH would work but web pages wouldn't load. And the problem with that is that because some routers are not returning the do not fragment fragmentation required ICMP message, it's a very difficult problem to debug. So we have time exceeded, echo request, which is the ping I talked about, source quench, which basically means stop sending packets, I'm too busy, I'm about to start dropping them, and host/network unreachable are some of the messages that ICMP can return. Any questions on any of that? Alrighty. Anybody got any questions on anything they would like to raise on this lecture before we finish up for today?
Nah. Might as well mention this. I think I mentioned it before. I run a... And just for the five other people who run it this way, I might set up a slightly esoteric, because I've got a modem that uses PPPoE, and rather than bridge it and put that up on the router, because the last time I tried that, it wasn't working for me, so I just told the router to exist on a different subnet. So it's running on 192.168.20, or, yeah, 2.0, I think, instead of 0, or instead of 192.168.1. And I was just wondering what terrible things that does behind the scenes.
Basically, if you run your router on a different subnet, it will mean that without correct routes in the routing table, you will be unable to reach its management interface, because your machines will not be able to communicate with the management interface. And the upshot of that is that if the router is on a different subnet, its NAT will not come into play, and you will be using the NAT of the modem, or vice versa, depending on how you've got your configuration set up. You may, in fact, be using the NAT of the modem and not the NAT network address translation of the router. And if you have stuff behind two layers of network address translation, it can be difficult to forward ports for particular machines, because you will have to forward those ports on both network address translators.
Okay, because I can get to the configuration pages of both devices without a problem.
It's on the website, under Contact Us. Well, that's something you would have to look into. I'd say default routes are handling that for you, and you would be able to get to both of those. Sometimes one of the things that a lot of people do when they're setting up networks, and this is a common mistake, is that they have, for example, a cable router that automatically does network address translation, but it only has one port on it, and then they get another one of those Linksys or Belkin or Netgear or D-Link or whatever sort of devices that's got five ports on it, you know, four LAN ports and a WAN and perhaps a wireless interface, and then they plug that directly into their cable modem. And a lot of people have trouble when they get these devices of plugging, say, for example, two routers together, which complicates their network setup, and they end up having two wireless access points connected together and two levels of network address translation, which can make things quite difficult to debug. And if it's incorrectly configured, you can actually have a case where some machines will not see other machines on the network, because those two machines are actually on different subnets, because they're connected into different devices.
Yeah, I mean, I have a bit of an esoteric setup, because I have two, well, it used to be three, but we're down to two ISPs at home. And I have two different routers, but I have them on the same subnet, and only one of them doing, actually, neither of them doing DHCP at the moment. Oh, there's something else doing DHCP, one of the Linux boxes. But when I want to control sort of what traffic goes out what ISP, If I want sort of things to go out the cable rather than the DSL, I just set those addresses statically and set the default gateway to the address of the cable router.
Yes, and in fact, what you can do if your routers are smart enough and run Linux is you can actually have the load balancing on the routers decide which packets from which hosts go out to which networks, and that's called policy routing. But I can assure you that's not covered until course 3 or 4 because it's quite complex stuff. But it is actually possible to have the routers control that and go, well, if the packets came from dot 7, they're going to go out this gateway, and if the packets came from dot 8, they're going out that gateway. And you can actually do policy controls on the particular routers to have the routers make the decision rather than statically controlling the workstation's default gateway. However, statically controlling the workstation's default gateway is probably the simplest way to do policy control without getting into all that complexity.
Yeah, I've seen the interface for it, and I didn't understand what I was doing, so I didn't even spend a lot of time. I didn't attempt it. It might be fun at some future date.
Yeah, I felt the same way about it when I saw it, and you're looking at, you know, destination marking and all sorts of other things, and you're just like, well, no. Okay, so that's basically how that stuff works. And if we've got nothing else, then I'm going to stop the lecture there today, and I'm going to write up some exercises in the next day or so and post them up, and if everybody can attempt those exercises, and we will see how everybody goes, we will then hopefully clarify some of the subnetting confusion. We will be available on Skype all day, and we hope you all have fun doing the exercises and stuff, and we will all talk to you next lecture, if not before. Have a good evening, guys.